Sarah, we know, died when she fell into the fireplace. She died of her burns. And then Charlie, well, he died of scarlet fever. The other children lived to old age, and the eldest son, Arvid Hinman, did some farming on the family property for a while, and then he became the postmaster, and he served as postmaster between 1876 and 81. And at that time, the post office was on Main Street across from Church Square. He went on then later to open a mercantile store in Ellensburg, Washington. The eldest daughter, Mary Ellen, never married. She stayed her whole life in the Lanson Hinman home. She did do a lot of church work, and she was the favorite, Aunt Mary was the favorite of the next generation. Ida married Lonzo Riebel, and Lonzo Riebel, he worked as a clerk for the Lanson Hinman for a while, but he went on to the Bailey store, worked for them, and he became a banker. And he also acquired a fair amount of property in Forest Grove, and especially when he and J.W. Fuqua purchased the entire frontage of the Pacific Avenue between A and Main Street. He claimed the Sloan Hotel, which he let his sister operate for about 3 years. Then the Lebos moved to Monrovia, California. They sold the property and moved on. Oliver married Ella McDonald. And you may remember that Harley McDonald, her father, built the church for the Congregational Church. And he enjoyed Forest Grove so much while he was doing it that he built himself a home here as well and moved to Forest Grove. Oliver eventually moved to Ellensburg and he opened a hardware store there. And a while he served as postmaster. Lanson's third son, Lanson Jr., was a town trustee for a while. But he worked as a clerk for his father until his father closed the store in 1891. Then he went off to dental school. He went to the Philadelphia School of Dentistry, which became Temple University. After he graduated, he kind of worked his way back, filling teeth as he came, I guess, until he got to Ashland, where he married Alice Farlow. And they moved them to Forest Grove in about 1905. And he opened a dental practice up above the Heinz drugstore. And then after about a year, he went on down the street and opened his office up above the Hoffman Mellon building, which was the Wood Capel building. And I'm not sure which window he looked out, or probably he was in back there and didn't look out any of them, but he stayed there for a good many years. Lanson Jr. had three children, two daughters and one son. The youngest daughter was my mother, Ada Margaret, and the boy was Lanson Farlow Hinman, who we called Bud. Bud became a dentist and joined his father in practice in 1929, and then in 1954, I joined my uncle as a dentist as well. By his second wife, Sophia, he had two more sons. Carl Hinman was owned a harness shop here in Forest Grove. First he had it in his father's mercantile shop store, which lasted about a year, and then he moved up to where Pizza Schmitza is now. And he hired Dan Parsons to work for him there. Then he had to go down to New Mexico because of his wife's health, so he sold his harness shop to Henry Hamilton. And within a year, Henry Hamilton sold it back to Dan Parsons. So Dan Parsons ended up practicing in the old Pizza Schmitza harness shop. And I have to tell you that this horse that Dan Parsons so carefully put out every morning when he worked, my mother went down as a young child and pulled the tail off of it. But Dan Parsons is my great uncle on the father's side, so I hope you'll forgive us. Carl returned from New Mexico to farm for a while on the family farm, and then he bought Sam Hughes Hardware Store. Sam Hughes Hardware Store was right next door to where the News Times office is now. And he operated that for about 5 years, and he also served as a councilman during that time. But eventually he moved on then to 1913, the band. And, you know, Don Henman, who is his son. The youngest son, Frank, was what you might call the black sheep of the family. He was probably an alcoholic, and we give him credit for losing the family home. I'm sure it would still be in the family if it wasn't for Frank. I need to mention one other person, Margaret Henman, who we always called Dolly. Dolly Henman was Sam Lanson's first grandchild. He's the child of Arvid and Arvid's wife, Mary. Mary died when Dolly was 2 years old, so Dolly was taken to the Lanson Henman home and was raised by her grandfather. Arvid went on to marry Mary's sister, Flora. So, but by that time, Dolly was already in the father's household, and she stayed there for the rest of her time. But this is really important to us because Dolly was very close to her grandfather, and her grandfather told her many stories about the early years, and Dolly was always interested in history, and she wrote these things down. Many of the stories that we have are because she heard them from her grandfather, and she wrote them down and passed them on to us. And Dolly was, she graduated from Fallen Academy in 1888, and then 3 years later from Pacific University. Then she went on to work as a bookkeeper at Bailey's store, and eventually into the Forest Grove bookstore. But in 1918, she left Forest Grove to become a missionary. And she went to Turkey and spent the next 26 years in Turkey. And she came back then in 1945 to retire here. She never married. She says she slipped through the cracks, but she had boyfriends. She wanted us to know that. Now just a little early history, which you may not be interested in, but I have to tell you anyway. The first Henmans came from England in 1650. They stayed mostly in Connecticut and New York. And Lanson was born in New York at Hudson. In 1822, he worked for a short time for his oldest brother, Oliver Henman, who was a silk importer in New York. Very successful business, apparently. And he taught school a while in different places, but eventually ended up in Missouri, where he was very taken by the activity of the Oregon Trail. And he wanted to go to Oregon, I guess, and he signed up with Nathaniel Ford. My goodness, for my wife. Nathaniel Ford was organizing a train, and he needed help to bring his wagons and his cattle to Oregon, and so Henman signed on to do this. Now, the four wagon trains leaving that year, well, it seemed like the Ford train was the one who had the least trouble. They were the best organized, and they got along fine, except that it was a very wet year, just not like we're having out here, only kind of on and on. The Mississippi Valley flooded, and it held them back about a month before. They were a month slow getting into Oregon. But what seemed to be a difficult trip for so many, I think Lanson Henman found to be something of a lark. He really, I think, kind of enjoyed it. For one thing, there were two very experienced mountain men traveling with the Ford group. The trapping days were about over now, and the mountain men were, they couldn't go out trapping anymore, so they made their money helping the immigrants come to, guiding the immigrants. And Moses Harris was a jovial, happy-go-lucky mountain man that was signed on by Ford to guide them to Oregon. They called him Black Harris, usually. Maybe you've heard this name. But Black Harris, he had a very dark complexion. His face was pocked like he'd been burned with powder on it, and that's how he got his name. But along also was James Kleiman. James Kleiman was also a very famous mountain man. He'd spent a lot of time in the mountains. He went home and he tried to settle down, but he found he just wasn't happy unless he wasn't feeling good unless he was out in the hills. So he was going along on the train just for the adventure. He had no purpose in going to Oregon. He just wanted to do it. It was exciting.
Looks like a brother Ray Blanken.
He's got a little face there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
But these two old trappers, when they Hinman was in the mess group. It was a smaller group with the main group that they did this so that the cattle didn't over-forage and whatnot. They broke them down smaller groups. And Hinman traveled with these two mountain men, James Lyman in particular. And they were outlandish storytellers. And I can't imagine what the campfires must have been when these two men started trying to outdo each other. It must have been marvelous. But much of our knowledge of the 1844 Oregon Trail was because Kleiman kept wonderful diaries. He had such colorful language, it's really a joy to read them. It wasn't great English, but it was colorful English. When the Ford train reached the Blue Mountains, why, Hinman and Black Harris were sent on ahead to the Quitman Mission to arrange for supplies. When they got there, why, Marcus Whitman found out that Lanson had some teaching experience, and he offered him a job teaching to the mission children, which he accepted. And he found that the experience of living with the Whitman family was a profound experience for his life. He became a devout member of the church there, and he was baptized by Henry Spaulding. And for the rest of his life, I cherished the memory of Marcus and Narcissa Whitman. That really changed him, I think. But life at Wailapu wasn't all happiness. On the same train in 1844 with the Sager orphans, and I think you probably all know the story of the Sager orphans. They arrived at Wailapu, and the Whitmans adopted them, and they became members of the school. And Narcissa Whitman demanded obedience of her children. And Hinman obliged them with very strict discipline. And the Sager children thought that he was a tyrant, a black-hearted tyrant who enjoyed torturing children. They didn't like him at all. In fact, in the spring, the younger Sager boy ran away, came to the Willamette Valley. Marcus Whitman enticed him back, but I think this changed Hinman's plans. I think he was planning to stay at the mission longer, and he decided that he would accept a job that was offered to him at the Oregon Institute. It was in its second year of classes in Salem. Oregon Institute, as you probably know, became Willamette University. And he stayed with the Reverend David Leslie. Can you imagine looking across the breakfast table? They called him Father Leslie. He must have been a kindly person. But during the 2 years that he was at Oregon Institute, why, he found himself a wife. He found Martha Gerrish, who was the daughter of a Methodist circuit rider. He was living in the East Plains at the time. Martha was 15 and a half years old and a student at the school. And I think what would have been probably not accepted now seemed to be commonplace at those times. 15 and a half years old was time to get married, apparently. In the summer of 1847, there was a group of Salem men that wanted to print a temperance newspaper, and they hired Hinman to go back to the Congregational Missions, Wailapu and where Spaulding and the others were, and try to get the mission press that they were using. They were printing the Nez Perce language books. And he did this. He got the mission press, took it back out as far as the Dalles, and then they realized that at that time that the restrictions that Spaulding had put on this weren't acceptable to the Salem men. He wanted to inspect everything that they wrote, and they didn't want to be bothered with it. So it stayed at the Dalles for a while. Then it did come on to Hillsboro, where the Reverend Griffin used it to print the paper. And the paper turned out to be pretty much a tirade against the Catholics, accusing them of the massacre. The thing that this trip did accomplish, though, why, Hinman was hired by Marcus Whitman to administer the Wauscopa Mission at the Dalles, which is a Methodist mission, and Whitman had just purchased it, and he needed somebody to take care of it, so Hinman was hired to do this. But he was there just about 2 months when the massacre occurred. Strange things happened. A courier was sent from Fort Walla Walla to go to Vancouver. He stopped at the Dalles, and he wanted to get a boat, and he wanted Indians to help him go up the river there, and Hinman helped him do this, and decided that he would go along since he needed to get medicine for the Indians. They were having measles there, and he needed to treat them. So he went along, but nothing was said about the massacre. He had no idea what the courier was going to Vancouver for, and that there was even a massacre. And so when he got to Fort Vancouver and had some big factories audit him, and Douglas read about the massacre and the threat to the other missions, why, he was beside himself. He realized that he had left his wife and his young daughter, which he had by that time, unprotected at the Dalles, and they were in great danger because there was talk of other massacres taking place. So he got back quickly, and he did find that indeed the threat was real, that there was danger, but he managed to avoid it. And the outcome of all this was great consequence to the Willamette Valley, because all these people came into the Willamette Valley. And can you imagine all these preachers in such a small area? It was something to behold, I think. Hinman had taken a donation land claim at the Patton Valley before he went to Wascopen, but he was coming back in the middle of winter, and he had no lodging on the donation claim, so he stopped at the Geiger farm to settle down. He left his children and family there at the Geiger farm shortly after he got there, and he and about every other person in the Willamette Valley then went on down to California to look for gold. He went both in 1848 and again in 49. And with him went Henry Sewell. We were talking about the Baptist Church in North Plains, and I think that there might be a connection with Henry Sewell to that, because he was in the church there, and I think it was the Baptist, I'm sure it was the Baptist Church, whether it was that particular one, I'm not sure. But we need to look into that. Anyway, they went down each time they got sick and came home with about $500 apiece. But the influence of the gold rush went far beyond that, because, for example, the three of the four schools that were significant schools in the Oregon country at that time that had preceded Walton Academy, of those, three of those had to close the doors because of the lack of people. They had no people in the area. The only one that survived was Oregon Institute at Salem. But in Forest Grove, it was having somewhat of an opposite effect, because Grandma Brown saw an additional need for an orphan asylum then, so she and Harvey Clark got busy and they set up their orphan asylum, which laid the foundations for Twelfth Academy and the University. It's quite a school. This is drawn from the letter of Cyrus Walker describing it. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but we tried to follow it. Gold affected the economy in other ways, though, that you may not realize. There were a lot of settlers in Forest Grove that had orchards. They were raising apples, for example. And Hinman had set up a store in partnership with Isaac Meyer in the 1850s, and they were buying apples. And they would take the apples, they would ship them down to San Francisco, where they were sold. And you were sure to get at least a dollar an apple down there, and maybe up to $5 an apple. But in 1859 alone, Naylor sold 27 different varieties of apples to the Hinman Meyer store. And they took down 37,370 pounds. They used three different steamers to transport the apples down to San Francisco. And ironically, Hinman was returning on one of these steamers from San Francisco when it hit a rock off of Cape Mendocino and it sank. He had $8,000 worth of supplies on it for his store, probably from what the apple profits, I imagine, went down to that ship. But he felt lucky because there were 38 people that were drowned at that time, so he did survive and he was thankful for that. Other ways that gold affected the people in Forest Grove area and Oregon country was the need for food in the Fraser River area, the cattle ranchers were driving cattle up to the Fraser River mines and selling them. This was in British Columbia. Then a little bit later, well, Hinman took a load up in 1859, he drove up a herd. And then in future years, by his brother-in-law, Darling Smith, made regular drives from Patton Valley up to the Caribou mines, which were a little bit farther north. And then finally, there's another flurry of gold fever in the 1860s. This one was instigated by the search for the old Blue Bucket mine that the terrible Meek Trail people had stories of. But they found gold, they may not have found the Blue Bucket mine, I don't know. But they went from the Baker area over to the Lewiston area where the latest strike was, and then there was another strike over to Boise Basin. Hinman's feet couldn't stand it. Martha had died by this time. He left the children with the Elisha Tanner family, and he went off to the gold fields again. But this time he was representing the Hinman Meyer store and taking supplies to the miners. But there were other things that were happening during this time. The increasing number of immigrants that were coming in were aggravating the Indians, and the gold miners were getting into their territories, and they were becoming unhappy, and that was upsetting them. And Indian uprisings were becoming much more common, and especially along the immigrant trails, they were taking their spite out on the immigrants. And then the Civil War was happening. The Civil War came in. This changed thing too. Even Oregon had to experience the Civil War. But the military regulars were being taken back east. They weren't able to guard the trails anymore like they had been. And we had a governor then, Governor Whitaker, who was a secessionist. He wasn't cooperating with them. He didn't want to enlist new people into the army. So a problem was created. By 1864, things were looking very dark. The Confederacy was winning some of the battles, and the secessionists were becoming much bolder, and there was a group being formed in the area. They called themselves the Knights of the Golden Circle, and they were a secret organization. They met in secret, and they were planning uprisings to disruptions of the area. And the students at Pacific University sort of made a game out of it because they enjoyed spying on these secret meetings. And I don't know of any, it was a little dangerous game to play, and I don't know of any harm that came from it, but nothing seemed to develop from it. But the situation was looking so bleak at that time, Forest Grove formed some home guards, mostly made up of students from Pacific University and from Tualatin Academy. Some of them were as young as 12 years old. They were led by the university professor Tanner. He was Captain Tanner. Rifles were furnished to them from the state arsenal. Then there was a meeting of the citizens on the Tualatin Academy steps. They were trying to recruit people for the 1st Oregon Volunteer Infantry. Narvet Hinman was one of them who signed up. A letter was received from Camp Reed near present-day Twin Falls, where Arvid was guarding the immigrant tails. And he described, he reported that there were two or three Indians killed on a recent excursion. He met here Cyrus Walker, who was a lieutenant at the time and the eldest son of Elkanah Walker. So the Forest Grove boys made it into the Civil War in that way. While this was happening, the Lansing Hinman left the gold fields and went back to New York, where he found himself a wife. He came home in 1865 with Sophia. He also, by ox cart, brought a load of supplies for the store. Sophia's sister, Martha, came some years later. Martha was the wife of Fran Barnes, who I think most of you recognize as being the famous bow and arrow maker in Forest Grove. So Sophia and Martha were sisters. Going back just a little bit now, I want to talk about something about the politics that was being affected by the Civil War. As a group, the Republicans opposed slavery, although most of them didn't seem to really embrace the black community. But in 1862, there was a coalition formed between the Republicans and the Democrats who didn't labor slavery, and it was called the Union Party. And Hinman was elected to represent Washington County at the convention, their state convention. Unfortunately, Martha was dying of tuberculosis at this time, and it had to let Wilson Bowlby, who was the Forest Grove physician and druggist, go as his proxy. A.C. Gibbs was nominated by them, and he was elected as the governor. He replaced the secessionist Whitaker. Gibbs was the second state governor for Oregon. It gets confusing with provisional governors, territorial governors, and state governors, but he was the second state governor. But the majority of the Union Party held through 1866, when Ransom Hinman was elected to represent Washington County in the state legislature. But this was beginning to, sort of the beginning of the loss of control, and it's going to the Democrats. But the interest is that the 1866 legislature easily ratified the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which forbid discrimination against the black citizens. But 2 years later, the 1868 legislature tried to rescind this. This gives you a little bit of an idea of what was happening to the politics in Oregon. And the explanation was that there was increased numbers of people coming from the southern states on immigrant tails, and they were looking for new land. They'd lost their land in the Civil War, and they were looking for the cheap land out in Oregon. So more southern people were coming, it was becoming more Democrat. Another thing that the 1866 legislature did was involve the railroad. U.S. Congress had just offered 20 sections of land for every mile of railroad and telegraph line that was connected to the California Railroad. And Governor Woods was encouraging them to enact laws that would take advantage of this, in which they did, in fact. They gave Gaston, who had the West Side Railroad, gave him right to administer the grants that were made by the government. But again, in 1868, why the legislature reversed this. And I think you all know the contest between the East Side and the West Side Railroad, and how the West Side Railroad skipped Hillsboro and Forest Grove because they wouldn't give money to Holiday to put the line through their towns. But such names as Joseph Gaston and Holiday and Henry Villard came to the prominent to the front. The 1866 legislature, after 16 ballots, elected Henry Corbett as U.S. Senator, and Corbett, a fellow trustee of Pacific University with Lansing Hinman, obtained an appointment for Hinman as Collector of Customs in Astoria, the Astoria Port. And he served in this position for 6 years until John Mitchell was elected in the Senate to replace Corbett. I don't know if Mitchell is a name that you recognize or not, but he was prominent in Oregon politics for a number of years. But in the end, he was supposed to be a bigamist. He was going under an assumed name. His name was Hipple. He was influenced by bribery, which was brought out. He was the attorney for Holiday and did considerable unethical things at that time. So he was somewhat of an unsavory character. During his years, Hinman operated two different stores in Forest Grove, and I've talked a bit about the Hinman Meyer store already. It occupied the corner of Pacific and Main Street where the bank is now. The store itself probably sat where Timrick McPickle jewelry store is at the present time. But by 1875, the building was removed. It was purchased by the Masonic Lodge along with the adjacent property, and Burt Hall was built on the site. And Burt Hall, as you probably know, I'm talking to people who know more about Forest Grove than I do.
Here too.
What's that?
We have new people here too.
Oh, is that right? Oh, yeah. Well, stop me if I tell you lies too. But Burt Hall was sort of the meeting place for the city. They had rallies there, and they had boxing matches, political meetings, public gatherings, and they even saw the first motion picture in Forest Grove at Burt Hall. And the upstairs served as the lodge for the Masons. And when the Lansing returned from Astoria, he built his second store, which was on the southwest corner of the Pacific University campus. He advertised extensively in the regional newspapers, and from all signs, he had a very successful story until retiring in 1891. His 60-day second annual clearance sale announced, "Cash talks. Come in and get my prices and see if I mean business. Everything goes at a large discount for cash." I asked my wife if I should compare this to Tom Peterson, and she said, "No, don't." So it sounds like it to me. But by 1895, the building had been divided and it had been moved to the Hinman property, the neighbors, to make houses for others. In later years, the store became occupied, the store lot became occupied by service station. And at this time, it serves as a parking lot for Pacific University. Now, I have to tell you that Forest Grove was not always the quiet town that you think it was. For example, there was the time of night in 1876 when the Hughes, the Hinman, and the Hoxter stores were broken into. They were unable to blow the Hoxter safe open with powder, so they went next door and borrowed an axe from Collier, came back, and all this went on with the guard dog watching them. But the suspect was apprehended near Joseph Meek's place, but they didn't find any evidence of theft. But the paper wondered why they didn't look in his carpet bag. But the remark the paper made was that breaking into safes is getting monotonous hereabouts. Oliver Hinman had been sleeping in the building to protect it, but that night he wasn't there. But another night, he managed to take a shot at a fleeing burglar. Arvid made the papers when he took an excursion with students and six wagons went excursion of students to Chehalem Mountain. These were students, I think, from Pacific University. But coming down the hill, the horses got scared and out of control, so one of the girls jumped out screaming as she went, which scared the horses even more. And the only way Arvid got the wagon stopped was to sideswipe a tree, but in the process, Hattie Condon, the niece of Thomas Condon, was thrown out. But she didn't get hurt, fortunately. Maybe more adventuresome was the 4th of July trip to Portland taken by Oliver Hinman. Oliver was invited to accompany his friend Charlie Cornelius and his father Ben and two daughters. In Portland, they checked into the rather elegant Esmond Hotel, and then Charlie and Oliver left the hotel to check out the town. And father Ben followed along a little farther behind. As they rounded the corner of First and Morrison, they heard shots, and they went back around and found Ben Cornelius had been shot and was dying in the street. He had faced off against Jack Powers, who was his son-in-law, and with whom he had a bitter disagreement over the treatment of his daughter. Charlie Cornelius went on to become a doctor, and at one time he was the Multnomah County coroner for a while. Less traumatic was the exciting party that Mabel Hinman and half-sister Dolly had for the ladies and gents in 1896. They spent the evening playing games. Among them were hide-and-seek and wink-em, blink-em.
No, not.
The paper reported they all voted at the end of the evening, and it was unanimous that it was the most enjoyable evening. Do you think that goes on in the dormitories now? I kind of doubt it.
No.
I don't think so. When Hinman moved to town from his donation land claim in 1854, he started buying property from the Harvey Clark donation land claim. And he bought about a total of 160 acres that was mostly from the Harvey Clark claim. This comprised the east end of the claim. Today it's partially divided into Joseph Gale's school. This is the Hinman Park here. Here's the park end of Pacific and South Park lots and whatnot. But now it's the Joseph Gale School property, the Schick Edition, Linwood Park, and Sheeler Manor. And I notice more homes are being built right now down on the opposite the highway, so it's continuing. And of course, the Bakchus are on here. The house was surrounded by orchards at that time. There were orchards both about a block up into the north and to the south. There was three blocks of maple trees that extended in front of the, along the Hawthorne. And I have to tell you that Marilyn Dean Mason have had quite a fight with the city to keep what you see out here still. They tried to have them taken down, but they're looking good, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, they're still there.
Yeah, we appreciate that. The redwoods were likely planted in the 1860s from the John Porter nursery. This is from seed that he brought back from California in 1869. The Hinman's first home on this property, according to Dolly Hinman, was originally occupied by Cushing Neals. He said it was a long, low, one-story building just north of this house, not too far away. After he moved into this house, why, they took down the Eels home and they took the timbers out to his farm in Patton Valley. I think you agree with me that the best guess when this house was built was between 1874 and 76. Is that what you decided? And the builder was Irving T. Smith. And this was the father of Arvid Hinman's two wives.
Irvin
Els. Huh? Irvin Els. Irvin Els. Not done. Okay, well, Smith built several Forest Grove homes and buildings, among them his own home on the end of Main Street, faces on 16th Avenue. It's still there. You can go look at it if you want. Instead of turning, why, go straight and you'll just about go into it, not quite.
It's a little
bit. It does look, well,
it has
you can tell it's the same, I think, but
hand.
It does.
Yeah.
And the snow kind of makes it pretty, I think. Mm-hmm. There's so many trees there, it's hard to see too now. Another building that he put up was the beautiful building that graced Pacific University's campus, Ladies Hall. And he later built and operated a furniture factory on the corner of Main and 19th Street. This was in partnership with Buxton. Hinman used this property to raise fine Percheron horses, which was, I think, a hobby of his. He also had a small dairy on the property. If you look in some of the old pictures, they're hard to see, but you can see a barn in the background here. And Dean has a picture of it here, too. It's just barely visible, but it was quite a large barn, which he had, and he also had a granary, a milk house, and had a carbide plant which he manufactured gas to operate the lights. I'm not going to tell you a lot about the house because I think Dean and Marilyn can tell you everything you need to know about it, the changes that have been made in it, what's still the same, some of the structures that are unique, and maybe you'll do that afterwards.
Sure. If anybody has any questions,
uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Throughout the years, Lanson was on a number of committees, both church, town, and county. He was active on the Congregational Church, where he was a trustee and a deacon, and on building committees. His wife, Sophia, and Mrs. Marsh were the first deaconesses that the Congregational Church in Forest Grove ever had, which is quite an honor. He served on the County Agriculture Committee, which planned the first Washington County Fair in 1844. Spent his time as Justice of the Peace, County Commissioner. 54. I should let her do this, she knows it by heart. He was also agent for the Southern Pacific for a short time. You can tell I'm not a public speaker.
Doing fine.
I'm not even a good reader.
Doing fine.
Good, thank you, you're kind. In the 1890s, while Forest Grove was fighting disease, the population was furnished by well water, and the waste was collected in cesspools and septic tanks, and the wells were becoming polluted. And by 1895, the citizens were pushing for wholesome water to be brought into them. A city committee was appointed to look into this, and another committee, which Hinman was on, was appointed to check the costs of it. And the result was the water was pumped out of Gales Creek into a water tower beside the Laughlin Hotel there. But basically it just furnished fire protection and irrigation for the population. And it wasn't until 1908 that they actually got water brought in. They brought it in from Clear Creek Canyon out by Gales Creek. About 7.5 miles of log pipe was laid down, which had been bored with a 10-inch hole down the center. I'd like to see how they did that. And wholesome water was distributed to the citizens by more log pipe, or wood pipe. Hinman served as mayor in Forest Grove in 1897. And again in 1899. His challenge in 1897 was to get the city on a firm financial footing. When he took office, why, the treasury consisted of $1.09, and ordinance to license, tax, and regulate certain businesses were passed with many, many amendments to it. One of the biggest expenses was for 600 cords of wood to be purchased at $1.50 a cord to operate the powerhouse for the power supply. But they apparently ended the year with a $59 balance, and they seemed happy to have it. Can you take more?
I can take more.
The Forest Grove banking business seems like a dull subject, but it did provide some excitement. Bank of Forest Grove was established in 1889 with Charles Heap as the president. Hinman was one of seven directors. One time, the stationery listed him as a vice president. But the bank closed its doors for a short time in 1895 while Keith got his financial affairs in order, and Mayor Hughes examined the books at that time. But fortunately, the doors opened again, and everybody was paid dollar for dollar, so no money was lost. The business was sold then in 1896 to Antone Fanner. A year later, Antone Fanner disappeared. And sent a letter to the clerk of the bank, and the clerk was told to close the doors and make assignments to Sam Hughes and A. Hinman for the benefit of the creditors. Apparently he had a mental breakdown, and he saw this coming on. It happened to him months before, and they found him in a hospital in Canada, and he recovered, and he came back to Forest Grove in about 2 months, and the customers were paid dollar for dollar, so again nobody lost money. But he did this thinking that he was protecting his customers. I'm not sure how that protected them, but anyway, they did get paid. Then in 1898, Haynes, purchased the Banner Building to open a bank with former Sheriff F.T. Kane as cashier. You were talking about William Kane, I think this is his son. Yeah. The bank closed its doors in 1908 when it was discovered the cashier had manipulated the books and money was missing. Of interest is that it was the same F.T. Kane that opposed Hinman in 1901 when he made a third run for mayor. Hinman was running on the temperance tickets, and F.T. Kane wanted free liquor, and this is one of the few instances when my tongue's getting spastic. This is one of the instances when the free liquor did win, but nevertheless, Forest Grove didn't get free liquor, so. Probably his greatest interest was his association with Fallon Academy in Pacific University. In 1853, he was made a trustee of Fallon Academy. Then in 1854, when the charter was changed to make it Fallon Academy and Pacific University, why, he automatically became a trustee of at that time too, a charter member. From 1879 until he retired, well, I'm going to go back to that. He served for 24 years as financial committee. In 1879, he was elected as president of the trustees, and he served until 1905 as the president of the trustees, and then until 1908 was president emeritus. He died in 1908. And this makes 55 years and 2 months, which he served as a trustee, which is a record that hasn't been equaled yet, may not be. But during these years, he saw the school grow from a single building to a mature campus. It started with one building, and he had the honor in 1893 to go with Mrs. March to break ground for Marsh Hall. And the following year, he went back to help lay the cornerstone. He made an address in that vacation. But his most challenging years came around 1890, when an attempt was made to remove the campus to where Portland University now stands. And this is a most complicated situation. Portland Academy and Pacific University were chartered through the efforts of the Congregational and the Presbyterian Church Association. And the charter protected the trustees from being controlled by the church or any other organization by making the trustees self-perpetuating and responsible to themselves. And then when George Atkinson went east, he tried to obtain the support of the American College and Education Society, and this was something they demanded too. They wanted the board to not be controlled by any church or any other organization. And if they failed to do this, by any money which this organization, which was a benevolent, they obtained money from benevolent people back east and saw that it got to the schools out west. Any money, they found a letter at the Whitman archives that Ellis had written to Myron Eales, I think. Called the church a dead church, called the town a dead town. He said if they didn't get the school out of Forest Grove right away into Portland, why, they could not be saved. And this nearly came to pass. But Hinman and fellow trustee Myron Eales worked quickly to make the constitution changes they felt were necessary. They went out and tried to find a president that would be unquestionably accepted as a congregational president. They pacified the Education Society and the Congregational Association, and they demanded, they did retain self-perpetuating trustees, and they demanded one final concession, that the school would forever remain Forest Grove. And they managed to get this passed, and the school was saved at that time then. But in a speech at the 50th anniversary of the university, Professor Barron declared that Hinman stood like a rock when the shock came, and almost unaided and alone prevented the flood of sectarian control from sweeping Pacific University from its moorings. Hinman died in 1908. He was 86 years old at the time. I'm sorry my tongue told you things that weren't true, but I hope that you were able to interpret them. And if you have any questions, you've sat there a long time, maybe you'd like to get up and move, but I'd be glad to stay here and answer any questions if you have.
Oddly enough, I'm from Walla Walla.
Are you?
I can remember 774321. I can remember those stories of the Whitman Monument, the massacre and some of those things.
Yes.
When my family came.
And you were a freshman. You went up and looked at the stone too, didn't you?
That's right.
Or did you go to school?
No, I didn't go to school. I was raised there. My family followed some of that same trail, landing in 1694 in Philadelphia and coming up through Oregon, Portland, Oregon Trail. It's amazing.
It's interesting country around there. My wife and I are both, she was raised and she didn't leave Walla Walla until we were married. I saved her from Walla Walla. But
she is from Walla Walla?
Yes.
Are you?
We both went to Whitman College.
Crowman.
Crowman? K-R-A-L. I need to know your name.
My name's Harmon.
Harmon.
My father was sheriff and my aunt and grandmother were teachers from 1650.
Her family still lives there. Two of my daughters are in Walla Walla now.
Interesting.
Anything else that...
Marvelous stuff.
George, have you put together the genealogy, just map the genealogy? Because for me, there are so many names connected that are important names in the development of this town. And one of the things I've always wanted to see is particularly the Hinman family, because of so many branches that it takes,
We've probably done this at times, but I don't know that we have anything right at the moment. Do we have my wife's the genealogist.
I have worked at it, but he isn't interested in genealogy per se.
Well, I'm interested
so
in it. I enjoy the stories of the people.
For local research.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We could do that. I'm sure we have the information on a lot of it anyway.
I've got it all on family charts, but I don't have a pedigree chart.
You need a cartologist to do that one.
No, on my father's side, I've been tracing the Parsons family in 1815, mm-hmm. and Dan Parsons, but there was quite a few Parsons around. And the old Parsons grist mill out in Dilly, and there's some interesting stories there too. But we can trace that family.
you have all this interesting material that you gave us, is it available in a book?
Well, I have put it in a book, and I put that book, and it's, there's a copy in the, Mrs. Olson's giving me flares here now. I printed 50 copies, and pretty much all of them have gone out to relatives, and I've put some, one in the library, I've put one in the Washington County Library.
There is one here.
Not the Washington County, the historical library. Marilyn has a copy. And I had a loaner copy, which has been loaned for several months now, but and Pacific University has been.
Those pictures too?
A lot of them. Yeah. I, there's a copy right here behind me. If you want to browse through it, I think that Dean would let you do that.
Amazing.
Oh well, pictures. I've raided every relative's book, taken pictures. I haven't taken their books, but. I've taken pictures of the pictures, and I've tried to collect all the pictures I can find of the family. I've enjoyed that. I do that through the genealogy.
What is the title of your book?
Lance and Hinman, the Pioneer of 1844. So clever.
Even before Rome, wasn't it?
Well, there is a book in the church, too, if you find it.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, he mortgaged the house, never paid the mortgage, and just, I don't know what he did with his money. He didn't earn any money for one thing. You know, he worked very rarely.
The family home is this home?
Yes.
And he just didn't pay.
He moved out before he lost it, I think, and it was idle here for a number of years.
Actually, it was taken. It was finally taken for taxes.
Yeah.
Well, Mrs. Hinman died, his second wife died, and was it 26?
Oh, I'm thinking 18.
18.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I beg your pardon. That's when the house was, the house was lost in 26, that's right.
Yeah.
That's when the house was lost. And, you know, like George says, he pretty much just let everything go as far as the finances were concerned. The property, that's when the property was starting to get split up through inheritance and just him selling off chunks for money, and he did that for years. And finally the house was lost. It was abandoned for somewhere around 3 or 4 years. It was vandalized quite heavily. A lot of the fixtures and stuff were destroyed at that time.
This was in 1926?
Yeah, from 26 to about 1930, thereabouts. I don't know exactly. Caught me by surprise here, George. I can't remember the gal's name. That
Cox, maybe.
Cox. Was it Cox? Yeah. Okay. She purchased the house, and I don't know who she purchased it from.
Her father bought it. I think was he a professor at Pacific, and he bought it.
He bought it for her as a gift.
Yeah.
And I don't remember. I don't think I ever knew who he purchased it from.
I think I know, but I can't tell you right now. But
it's a secret. And she did the first renovation of the house, and basically got it, you know, all the windows were, not all the windows, because there's some original windows still here, we think, but a lot of the windows were damaged. There was some, allegedly some pretty ornate bathroom fixtures that were broken up, and they're supposed to be in the well out back right now. All that stuff is coming down the well.
The stamp collection.
Well, who knows what? It's all under our concrete patio back there, so. I don't know. That might be something for the next people, but anyway.
1926, this was still fairly rural.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although
he was allegedly to have electricity while Lansing was still alive. So that was, and he died in 08, so there was some kind of power here. I don't know if it was from the city network or whatever. There couldn't have been much. And I don't know if it was just something like a street light or if there was power to the house. We don't know that. But he was one of the first, if you read through some of the old city documents, he was a real strong proponent of getting street lights, which was like 4 or 5.
Yeah.
You know, getting Forest Grove lit.
And they cut, I didn't mean that, in 1923, where Frank mortgaged three parcels of property over to Mark Cox, so he was holding mortgages on the property.
Okay.
That came due and past due.
And I, you know, it might not have been, you know, I'm not sure if he lost the house to taxes or if it was just turned in lieu of taxes by somebody. I don't know exactly what happened.
Taxes weren't being paid, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so Cox owned the, Cox's daughter had the house for, we don't know exactly how long, but we do know, we had a fellow here, remember what was his name, that lived here during the war when it was a duplex. Remember, he was here at the open house, I can't remember his name. I got it written down, but anyway. And so we speculate she didn't own it at the time it was turned into a duplex. And it was two residents here, that wall was the division. There was a kitchen put back into the dining room, and then this wall here goes all the way through the end of the house. And there's two sets of stairs in the house, so this half used this half, and the bedroom's upstairs, with the upstairs bathroom, which was there at that time. We don't know if that's an original bathroom, probably not. And then the other half of the house used our kitchen where it is now, and that half in the downstairs bathroom. And he kind of went into detail how that was explained, and he was a young fellow when he lived here, so I assume that's accurate. In early 50s, it was purchased by Phi Beta Tau. And I don't know if they purchased it, or if the university purchased it, or what, but it was a fraternity house at that time.
Phi Beta Tau was
there. Yeah, the university did
not.
Okay.
The university had a part of that. Phi Beta Tau was a corporate entity.
Okay.
I just had one house, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it was, and the house, the house came under ruin for a second time, kind of in that era. And it was, there's all kinds of rumors and stories and everything about what took place here. There's,
most of it true.
I'm afraid so. The evidence.
This is an absolute coincidence, but an old friend of ours, who we've known for many, many years before living here, was a fraternity for 5 minutes out. And he was quite shocked when he found out that this was the place we bought. And couldn't get much out of him. He kind of clammed up on us. The first time he came in here, since after we owned it, he walked in here and he was really bizarre. It was really bizarre. He was quiet and unusually quiet. He was quite a character. And we just couldn't get him to talk. And finally, after maybe 5 or 10 minutes, he says, "You're missing the beer bottles." He says, "We need lots of beer bottles." And according to him, it's like that was kind of a ritual where they would see how many years they could go before cleaning out the beer bottles.
Actually, what he said, Dean, and I know you're friends of this party, so don't let this go beyond here. But he said, "You know, I think this might be the first time I was in this house sober."
The first time I've been in when there wasn't beer.
Oh!
Were you
I wasn't in my own house. I was in AC, which is the house I own.
Okay.
No, I have. One going down the door. Well, we know there's girls' names carved in the bricks
up
in the attic, and some of them have little marks behind them.
Scoreboard.
I have no idea what that means.
I know absolutely what that means.
But when we did some repointing in the bricks, we actually had someone do it. We said, "We really want to save these bricks."
And you did save the bricks?
Yeah.
Do we get to see them?
No.
I don't know. It might be someone you know.
Give us a few leads.
Anyway, the fraternity lost its charter in the late 60s just because they were so rowdy. Basically, it was pulled out from under them. And the house again was abandoned. And I'm not sure of the exact time frame, but for a year or two, it was lived in by, I guess you'd call them hippies, maybe ex-fraternity members or whatever, abandoned, no power, no electricity, and the place really suffered heavily. Mm-hmm. They cut the upper banister on the stairways down and burned it for firewood at that time. A lot of damage to the floor, a lot of, the place really, it, was, the only reason it was saved is nobody put the building destroyed. It was pretty pathetic. And it was saved by Marvin Wright this time, who was a fire marshal. And he purchased it in the late 60s, had lived here about a year, maybe a little longer, and then the house caught on fire.
Oh.
And him and his family were saved by an early morning milkman that noticed the blaze on the wood, on the roof. And yeah, well, at that time he was a captain or a firefighter or whatever. He said it's the only fire he'd ever been to that he didn't fight. Anyway, and this house, this side of the house was severely damaged. A lot of the plaster
was water damage.
And it was a pretty intense situation because the trees were fairly big even then. You know, I mean, that's 20-some years ago. So they were really concerned about getting this thing under control, otherwise the whole neighborhood would have gone up. The trees would have taken off. So there was severe water damage to the house. We think that's when that bay was lost. It was a bay just like this one here, in there. We know this room was opened up for the fraternity, but I don't think it was as you see it now. All the crown molding was lost because of the water damage. There would have been pocket doors or double doors or a wall or something here. That might have been open for the fraternity, but if not, then it certainly would have been the result of rebuilding this end of the house for all the damage. And then Marvin, I guess he's kind of credited for being the last guy to save the house, I mean, second time. And then it was sold to the Goodriches, and they owned it for about 3 years, and then we purchased it in the summer of 1990.
You can see why we're so thankful for the Masons taking care of it like they have.
I haven't stopped working on it.
Oh, no.
Well, you never do, you?
Never do.
Although there's some projects that you come up against that you decide, you know, the next owner really needs a few things to do. like that bay window, it would be nice if that bay could be put back, but, you know.
Well, obviously the fireplace isn't right. This was put in during the fraternity period. There's three flues in this chimney. This isn't the chimney here, but if you go up to the roof and look down, there's three flues on that chimney. There's a big ramp about underneath where her was sitting there, underneath the house, and that was probably a sawdust dump into a large cellar that's about the size of this room, only under this room. There's also a lot of tin work that run, they use the beam on the sides, the floor on the top, and tin sheeting on the bottom, and we speculate that was some kind of a vent for convection type heating. They probably had a sawdust burner in the cellar, and then they had, and this, it just runs the whole width of the house. There's markings on the floor underneath some furniture over here, about the size of a large vent. Directly in line with it in the hallway under the armoire is another patch the same size, and then in our, what we call the library in the other room, there was another patch under the carpet that's in there. So that's probably was the three heating ducts for the house, the three heating vents off of the one duct for the house. And then the rest was taken care of with fireplaces and wood stoves. One of the flues is probably for whatever kind of heater, I would speculate sawdust. Then they probably had two more fireplaces. Either, this was a two rooms here, there's markings under the carpet here. Where there was a wall, you can see quite clearly. With the Bloom construction, the foundation of the house gives you a perfect outline of where every wall was, and there's foundation right underneath there. So this happened, and plus it had never had a room this big in this case, so this wouldn't happen. So we don't know exactly the layout. Obviously this was a parlor. This room here would have been either a dining room or a second parlor. We don't know where the original kitchen was. There's mixed thoughts as to whether that was the kitchen, which I originally thought so because of some of the fixtures under the house. That was a kitchen at one time, but even it was lead pipe, and I don't know if they would have used that in the 40s when the house was renovated, do a duplex or not. At any rate, that would have been another closed room. The people that think it wasn't a kitchen thinks it was a dining room because the kitchen wouldn't have had that elaborate of a bay window. So I don't know, maybe so. It just seems that the lead pipe was, of course, who knows what kind of materials and where they got it when they remodeled this into a duplex. At any rate, that room wasn't as big as it is now. It was a little bit, the wall back there doesn't coincide with the foundation of the house. If that was the dining room, then our present kitchen would have been slightly smaller than it is now. Which leads me to think it might have been a pantry and that might have been a kitchen, but anyway, who knows. And then there would have been, I don't know if he ever had servants, but it's called servants quarters, the back quarter of the house over there, which is now split into a laundry room on one half and our downstairs bathroom on the other half. Which also tells me that there was, and of course in those days they wouldn't have had multiple bathrooms in a house. That would have been such an extravagance that there would have only been one bathroom. And it probably would have been upstairs by the master bedroom, which is where our current bathroom is now. So that might have been original, we don't know. But nonetheless, the downstairs one didn't exist then. Our library, and anybody's welcome to go over there when we have refreshments, one room over, is still very original. The wainscoting is an original type finish. I don't know if it's ever been refinished, but it certainly hasn't been painted. Unlike the wainscoting in the dining room. And the windows in there, a couple of them are even cracked, and we hesitate to replace them because we feel that those are all original windows. It was out of harm's way from the fire. They're very distorted to look through them. I mean, it's almost impossible to see clearly out of them. They're so bad. Yeah. And there are a lot of pot marks and looks like casting marks in them. So that's probably the best representation of what the house looked like originally. And I want to think these rooms would have carried on the same, design as that room. And again, who knows, but there was either pocket doors here or double doors opening this up into the either like two separate parlors or a parlor in the dining room opening up for a greater room. I don't think there was a fireplace upstairs, which leads me to believe there are either two fireplaces, one in this room and one in this room, or could have been two wood stoves or a combination of. Yeah, I would think so too, because the flues here would have been in the corner of each room, and I don't think they would have had a fireplace, so it probably was wood stoves, but who knows. They did funny things with flues in those days too. They'd have them going out all different angles, so there could have been a fireplace right in the middle of the wall with a flue going up diagonally to the chimney here. So who knows what was done.
You mentioned one time there's two doors. Finman had gentleman callers where they could go directly into his office.
Yeah, which was actually, that's right. That was the house from the gable down, or from the eaves down, is considered an Italian net. And from the eaves up is considered Gothic. And so the design of the house is Italian net / Gothic. The Italian net design is real prevalent with two doors, two entryways to the house. There would have been a set of double doors here. And the picture quite that George has, and there's one over there behind him. And again, you go look at it later. But the picture clearly shows a dual doorway, dual doors on that opening there. And if you open the door up and look down, you can see like where somebody took some putty or something and actually filled like a lock, a jam for a lock or something, right? About the midway between the side light and the door there. The side light would have been there. That would have been doors all the way across, probably. There would have been a glass up above, as indicated in the picture there also. But then around the side of the porch extends, makes a right angle bend to the right there. And it goes to the door that enters into the library from the outside. And that's the door George would have been talking about. And in those days, it was just the custom. The good old boys and their pipes and cigars and stuff were not allowed in the ladies' parlors. And so they just alleviated the problem by giving them a second door. They could come and go with their smelly old pipes.
I think that's a nice custom.
Well, and tell them what happens during an earthquake in this house. You explained it to me once, and I thought that was interesting.
Well, there's five redwoods on the property, and...
Let me say something first. This myth about animals knowing there's an earthquake ahead of time, our golden retriever slept through the whole thing. It wasn't until she kind of woke up and noticed we were running around that she figured something was going on. So.
Well, this house has been here a long time. It's obviously very well built. But we were upstairs in the bedroom during the earthquake. And, it was pretty frightening because we didn't know how long it was going to go on. It was pretty substantial. But this house swayed for a good long time after the quake because of the root structures of the trees. I mean, it was literally doing the boogaloo, I think, honestly, more than 5 minutes.
We were up there, and after it was all over with, we did the real smart thing, and that's go look out the window. And we're sitting there, and I couldn't keep my balance. But it was all, this was like maybe, while I was up, and I had my, I had enough time to get out of bed and put on a pair of jogging pants and a sweatshirt. So that would have been a minute or two after I woke up. I mean, I did this pretty fast, by the way. But I couldn't keep my balance. And I said, Marilyn, I said, we're still moving. And we both agreed on that. So we thought, let's just get out of here. Because I didn't know if the house was starting to settle or if it was sliding off the foundation. I didn't know what was going on. So we go out to the house, and I'm standing there, and I could look at the sidewalk, and of course it's pretty well cracked anyway, and I saw the cracks on the sidewalk moving. And so I kind of looked around, I don't know why, but I looked up and the trees were swaying. Probably the tips of the trees were going, I don't know, 15 or 20 feet. Just slowly, back and forth, and back and forth. And it dawned on me that it was the trees moving the earth. And that's what was making the house kind of, the house felt, it felt like a boat. Have you ever been on a boat with not at rough water, but just kind of, well, yeah, it just felt like trying to...
I didn't like it. I don't want to be in here again if it happens again.
The trees came from Porter, which you touched on just a little bit as far as the gold rush was concerned. If anybody's interested in that, Porter was down at the gold rush. And I think it must have been the second gold rush, maybe? The one.
Could have been, because I think it was in the... Yeah. I thought 69 was the date that I had seen.
And he, being down in the gold rush country in California, he fell in love with the sequoias. And I assume he was some kind of a botanist or something anyway. So he made provisions for bringing a barge full of saplings up to Forest Road. And in fact, his nursery is still, can be seen out there as a site on Porter Road.
Yeah. Quite a few redwoods.
There's probably 50 redwoods planted out there very close to each other, and that was his nursery out there. So these five redwoods came from there, and they were planted by Don's father.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In fact, it was a funny story, because one time Don was here.
Don Hinman is the grandson.
The grandson.
That's in Redwood, yeah.
And Carl then.
And so his father, Carl.
Yeah.
And it was said that two of Hinman's sons, Don says one of them was Carl.
Well, it would have been Carl and Carl.
Hardly.
Yeah, I guess so, to be the right age, you're right. Uh-huh. They planted these trees, and it was, I don't know if it was something that they did between the two of them, if it was a family ritual, if it was something from their father, but it was kind of a, it was called, they planted these trees celebrating their entry into manhood when they were young teenagers. And so that would have been around mid-1880s?
I suppose, yeah. Well, yeah, uh-huh.
There
were
several plantings of redwoods.
I don't think Potter...
Well, yeah, Potter himself was a little bit of a Johnny Appleseed, and his purpose in life was to get redwoods going up here.
Well, the trees in the Washington County Courthouse.
Yeah. Those came from Potter.
Yeah.
But these trees were planted by Hinman's son, and, you know, I don't know if he bought them from Potter or if it was given to him. I'm not sure what the deal was.
Yeah, they've turned up in a lot of interesting sites.
Yeah.
There's one that belongs to Hinman Jr.'s house, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right
they brought, Potter brought 500 sequoias up here with them. And we don't know how many was planted. I don't know how many was planted. We know that there's about 50 of them out at the original site. And I think the county claims there's 100 left. Does anybody know anything about that? So I don't know if some of them, you know, if they didn't, you know, when you transplant them, if they had a problem with them or what. But I don't know if this is something Potter didn't know or if it's something he just accepted, but redwoods usually don't even reach maturity for 200 or 300 years. Mm-hmm. It's a very long time. They're just now coming to the point, I mean, they're just now halfway to the point where they could repropagate. So that's why there's no more redwoods other than what he put here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And they need to be exposed to fire.
Absolutely, that's part of that. Oh, you're right. These are
the ones that fire.
Yeah.
But they're also very resistant.
When you go out, I don't know if anybody's familiar with redwoods, but feel the bark. It's very spongy.
Mm-hmm. You have to pet them as you go by. That's so pretty.
They're very messy, too.
Well, I have decaf and regular coffee sitting out, and then there's a 7-Up, and there's a punch that's made with cranberry juice and 7-Up, and some cookies and fudge on the table. Thank you very much, George.
George, you did an excellent job.
Well.
Thank you, everybody.
Just so much to hear that, thank you.
I happen to know that George has a very, very capable assistant.
Yeah.
Well, from Wawa, she has to be.
I don't think the house would have been lost in the beginning if Dolly had been here, but she was a half a world away in Turkey and didn't really know what all was going on.
Well, I know the letters that you copied.
As loyal as she was to family things, she would never have let it go without a fight.
Well, she was writing at that time about how concerned she was about taxes being paid. So.
Yeah. What's funny is I would like to know how much back taxes are owed. It was probably. Yeah, probably.
I have to pay the markers.
Ten cartons of cigarettes.
Well, nobody could have been much anyway. I mean, there wasn't enough years to accrue. Taxes weren't very much in those days.
If you're a Hinman family member and you're ever really missing the house, you can come help clean up that with you.
I'll think about that.
Maybe we can perpetuate that ritual somehow. The beer bottles, yeah, we can work on that too. Maybe carve the bricks. I'm not going to get involved
in that.
The pictures are all mixed up, but they're back here in the book.
Thank you. No, well, thank you. It was too long and kind of.
It had to be. We can't get down to such a thing. And it's perfect to store it. But.
There's a couple of late school pictures that were pretty well known. Well, I could go back to the old hall and be happy with it.
Really?
So, oh, that's a good town.
Yeah, it's
a pretty town.
Yeah,
it's a surprise. I don't even have water in the lawns in the pretty.
You can sit right there
under
the trees.
They have
all those
trees.
Yes, they do.
Boy, I wish mine was only blue marks like that. Yeah, mine's been patched.
Under that piece of furniture there's a couple of big chunks.
Yeah.
We lived in this house with people who got it. It was brought away. Terrible. No, we're not going to take that off. But at that time, I think it was wrong.
What time was
it? Yes, we bought our house in 61. Just waiting for it to get into far along.
Oh,
well, yeah, and we think the fraternity is going to open this up.
Yes.
I would imagine by that time it was probably still left over from the duplex.
Well, my father
Oh, yeah, he bought it in 1869. But it was a duplex, like I said, during the war. And I don't think the. That's about in the fraternity. Well, yeah, and I think it went from bad to worse when the fraternity had it. I mean, because they really didn't.
Yeah, I can't remember. I'm 55, I think it was going to be 5.
priority.
But you've done a long time.
Well, thank you.
You know, every day, I'm so tired of working. There's so much things, and how American things that I know, and all my folks.
Well, we worked on this house pretty intensely.
Did you do your own work? Did you talk to me?
I did most of it. There was a few things. And I'm traveling more now for work, and about the last 2 years, we really haven't done much, only a few things. But just because I'm traveling more, and I just didn't want to get burnt out on it. I didn't want to not come home to the house.
Well, I haven't had to do a lot of work in the last couple of years. It just seems like not everything's kind.
Well, that's just the way they are. You know, everything has a lifespan, and
I'm debating now, do I want a full foundation or should I put up some pillars like it was when we were in the
region? We're lucky with the foundation here.
I'm trying to get somebody to do that now.
And the problem is finding somebody who is willing to do it right as opposed to just do it quick. And
now Gladys Haynes has been real quick. But I need to live a little girl.
Yeah.
I have my backyard, I can get out of the mail.
I have a sales rep for a company called Feltro. We manufacture all the water engine parts. And I cover the state of Oregon and South Washington. I'm on my feet a lot, it seems like. Now that's a very sophisticated temperature control system.
Yeah, that you caught on the top, is that what she was asking about?
That's very early. I bought it in Waterford, Ireland.
We can get you.